Yes.
Have you heard of Discorder?
Yes.
That salty magazine from CITR 101.9 FM?
Yes.
Pick up your copy of this month's issue at Red Cat Records, Budgie's Burritos, the VPL, or at any of our other 132 distribution locations. This issue features Aura Kogan, Holy Hum, Van City Queens, Good Night Out, and Sawdust Collector, plus reviews of local artists, shows, and other creative endeavors. All in one Salty F publication.
Yes!
Yas, yas, yas.
Good evening, Vancouver. You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory. This is the UBC Happy Hour, a collaboratively produced show that is all about what's happening on UBC's campus. So this show is made by the UBC Affairs Collective. If you like what you hear and you want to help make this show, you can send us an email at ubcaffairs@citr.ca. Tonight we've got a really full and diverse episode for you. So we're starting off with the discussion of the Alma Stati trial, which has really rocked campus for the past year. And then for the second part of the show, we're going to be diving into culture at UBC, and we're going to be hearing about some bike art, the night shift at the Museum of Anthropology, which was a really cool event they're doing monthly. And then we're capping off the episode with some music from a UBC band called Melt. So first off, we have a lovely roster of folks in the studio today. So we're going to do a bit of a roundtable. So I'm Alex Lenz. I'm the UBC Affairs Collective Coordinator, and I'm also a international relations student at UBC. That's me to my left.
Hi, I'm Sadie, and I'm a first-year international student who's a member of the collective.
Hi, I'm Rahmatullah Sheikh. I'm a student of the School of Journalism at UBC and also a contributor to Democracy Watch, which is a current affairs show at CITR.
And my name is Samantha McCabe. I'm the news editor over at the UBC, which is UBC's student newspaper, and I'm also a political science student at UBC.
Nice. So, Sam, you have been covering the Alma Stati trial since the incident began last year, and particularly you've been doing a lot of work covering the trial for the past month since it's been ongoing. So can you give us a summary of the case, what happened, how we got to where we are now, just kind of the bare facts?
Yeah, totally. So there's a lot of nuances to this trial, but in brief, last October of 2016, there was an attack in Salish House at Totem Park on campus in which a male student knocked on the dorm room of a female student living in Salish House. And at 11:30 a.m., I believe it was a weekday, and proceeded to slit her throat and tried to choke her, and then her screams eventually attracted a fellow student to help. The police were called, and the man that attacked her was arrested on the scene. So following that, we kind of didn't know much about what was going on. We knew that he had been arrested and charged with attempted murder, aggravated assault, and assault with a weapon. And basically, obviously, the legal process is not brief, and we've been seeing his trial. His name is Thamar Al-Mustadi. He was 18 when the attack occurred and 19 during the legal proceedings. We've been seeing his trial play out this past month over about 3 weeks, probably about 10 days of trial, 9 or 10. And then in the end, basically, the court arrived finding him guilty for the acts that he had committed. The facts of the case were never really in dispute. What most of it was about was whether or not he was criminally responsible for his actions on that day, October 4th. And in the end, the court found that he was not criminally responsible on account of mental issues. A psychiatrist testified, called by the defense. Her name was Jeanette Smith. She testified that he was suffering from a brief psychotic episode at the time of the incident that ranged kind of from when he started at UBC in September of 2016 up until the days of the attack and just after, that rendered him incapable of appreciating the morality of his act. So incapable, he knew what he was doing, but he was unable of comprehending that it was wrong due to delusions and paranoia that he was experiencing at the time. So instead of going to jail, he's now been transferred to the Forensic Psychiatric Hospital in Coquitlam.
Yeah, so I think one thing, big kind of theme that comes up in this is mental health. So a quote from an October 20th article that you wrote is from his court case is that he remembers actively deciding not to seek counseling help, which was recommended by his residence advisor at the time because he thought that his stress levels were similar to those of his fellow students. So I think the timeline is really important because he was an engineering student. It was, you know, midterm season. Like, he was clearly really stressed with his work, as other witnesses testified. You know, like, it just seemed as though his stress, he himself kind of, it seemed as though he brushed off his stress, and stress is kind of normalized on campus. So can you maybe speak to some of the witnesses who kind of testified, who were kind of in his program and talking about this kind of stress that they were all feeling?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that it's 1 in 1,000, 1 in 2,000 situations where students are experiencing extreme stress that it would actually end up as an attempted murder. But nonetheless, it does attest to the extremely stressful situations that especially first-year students, especially international students, and especially applied sciences are put into daily at UBC, and the resources that are available to them and how those situations play out. I mean, during the trial, we saw that his acquaintances and study partners testified that he had seemed stressed. It was midterm season. He had seemed maybe very stressed, but they didn't attribute that to any significant mental health issues simply because they felt that that fit into the culture of student stress at UBC, especially in the engineering program. One of his acquaintances even almost giggled when the topic was brought up and the prosecution asked whether this was unusual or seemed at all irregular, and said, all of us are under this amount of stress. Have you heard of the engineering program? So that was a really interesting factor in this case. I mean, obviously it went beyond that into very significant mental health issues, but just a testament to how he felt that he wasn't exactly justified in seeking help because he was just another one of many. And even though his RA approached him and said that she felt that he would benefit from some counseling help, he didn't necessarily think that it was warranted based on his perception of the culture here.
Mm. So, Sadie, you are a first-year student here, and you're actually living in Totem Park. So before you came to UBC, did you heard of this case? And I guess kind of what do people in first year kind of know of this case?
Yeah, so when I first came to UBC, I knew nothing about this. And there was kind of rumors about it when I first came on campus. Oh, someone was stabbed in Salish. And that's kind of all I knew. And that seems to be all first year students know.
Yeah, so I think kind of further to that, So after the incident occurred, so October 4th, 2016, so last year, there was a lot of kind of controversy and mixed feelings towards the way that UBC addressed this problem. So they, I guess, sent out an email that was kind of cryptic to just a few residents, only a few kind of residents living in certain buildings, and kind of maybe, Sam, I know that you did cover it at that time. So can you kind of recall, like, what was that email like, and why were people kind of upset at the way that the school handled it?
Mm-hmm. So I believe there was an initial email sent out a few hours after the incident occurred to select first-year residences, essentially saying that there had been an incident, that the threat was no longer present, which I understand the need to respect the privacy of individuals involved, and they may not have had all the information, but I think it definitely frightened some students a bit more who hadn't known there was an incident to learn that it was to the extent that the threat had been taken away and that there was a threat to begin with. And then we heard reports that about a day later at 4 p.m. the next day, that a broadcast email was sent out to the entire university, which was also relatively vague. And there was a lot of student backlash that we heard over that. A, the untimeliness of the response, B, the vagueness, and C, the lack of support services that were offered following the event to just the general student population.
Mm. So in terms of the trial itself, I'm kind of curious, like, the witnesses who did testify, like, who were present there, kind of what were, like, their initial reactions, like, kind of who were some of, like, the key witnesses in this case?
So we heard from quite a few witnesses. We heard from several acquaintances of the accused. We heard from his residence advisor at the time, who had had multiple conversations with him leading up to in the days of the attack. We heard from the psychiatrist I previously mentioned, Dr. Jeanette Smith. We heard from Mary Hare, the victim herself, right on the first day of the trial. Alma Stoddy himself testified for 2 days, which was a very interesting 2 days as well. So there was, and I'm definitely forgetting a few, there were a variety of witnesses, all really attesting to A, that his stress levels at the time, his demeanor, and all kind of just building up the facts of the case as well, since even to be found not criminally responsible, you need to set the factual basis that the incident occurred for which he could be found not criminally responsible. And I also forgot the witnesses that pulled Alma Stoddy off of hair during the attack. Mm.
Yeah, Samantha, first of all, that was some excellent coverage, I would say, both as a student of journalism and a student of UBC. What I have in front of me is like a full-page coverage of the recap that you recently did in the October 24th issue of the UBC newspaper. But beyond the print coverage, what you also did was live tweet from the court, and which I thought was an interesting approach, because I'm just wondering, what was the preparation like at the newsroom before you went into the trial proceedings? Because I believe that the live tweets did give us an impression of this case beyond the legalities. It kind of brought out the nuances, the complexities, the body language of people within the courtroom. So could you shed some more light on that?
Absolutely, especially with a case as full as with as many nuances and different perspectives as this one was, we felt that it was important to really get students as engaged and knowledgeable as they wanted to be. And part of our coverage that we've been prioritizing with multiple stories this year is live tweeting. We find it's a helpful way for students to follow along, kind of really get the play-by-play of what's happening in a way that just simply isn't delivered when we condense it into a 400-word typical newsprint or whatever that may be. So, it was kind of an interesting combination of having to be on the fly reporting that, trying not to sensationalize or pull just quotes that were particularly hard-hitting, although those were definitely abundant, and really emphasizing that this was a case full of back and forth and really exploring the issue of his mental health at the time. And I'm glad that they came across as helping provide a lot of background info, because that was really our goal in the end, is to provide as thorough of coverage as possible.
Yeah, I found that the UBC's coverage compared to, like, for example, I read some other articles from the CBC and that were definitely not as detailed. Like there was maybe one or two articles that they did on the story and there was a lot of details missing that like it really simplified the case when this is something that affects like so many aspects of student life. And especially I think coming from a student paper, like this issue was so important for students. And like Sadie said, how there were like rumors going around. It's like when we don't get all the details that we need, people are going to fill in those details themselves. And that's going to lead to rumors. And that's ultimately, I think, going to only hurt the victim more in the end if people are, you know, filling in gaps with like what they think. The UBC, how did you guys kind of like make that decision to kind of cover this so in depth?
Mm-hmm. I think it was a very similar thought process to what I thought when we were tweeting, which was that this case from the very onset evidently wasn't just down to the fact that Al-Mustadi was an international student or that he was young at the time of the incident. Like there were so many factors, including his mental health, including the environment that students are put in, including relationship with the victim, of which there barely was one. They'd met twice. There were so many things that could be interpreted one way if they were just introduced in a sentence in one news article that we really wanted to explore. And as I've kind of said previously, reflect on how what they say about wider school topics like stress, like friendships when you get onto campus, like mental health in general.
Yeah, I think when you bring up a good point, which is like the youth, like the fact that both Al-Mustadi and Mary were so young when this happened. Of course, they were just first years. And it was interesting to me reading some other articles, not in the UBC, that, you know, they were calling him like a man. And mm-hmm. just like that word to me, I was like, man, like this is someone who's so young, but simply because you're like above 18, you're considered like an adult. And to me, that was kind of a crazy feeling because it's like, I know what I was like in first year and I was like not an adult at all. And like, I do not think that I would have been able to like, not that you can't be held accountable, but it's a really young age for something so intense, you know, to go through for both Mary and Al-Mustadi that like, when articles kind of characterize it as like an adult simply because of the age, like I think that from the UBC's perspective, like you guys could probably really relate to this case a lot more than other news sources. And so you can portray it in a way which connects to students. Like we all know that like we were really adults when we were 18, you know?
Of course. Yeah. And I think there's absolutely virtue in the legal system that all adult cases are tried in the same manner. And that really contributes to the fairness of the situation. But at the same time, for me personally, sitting in the courtroom, it was a little bit horrifying just seeing, I'm only a few years older than those involved in the case, but seeing the youth at play and these people's families watching these proceedings and their children go through this like rigorous trial process really hit home for me, especially as a student reporter. Like these are people trying to get on with their lives, especially in the context of him being found not criminally responsible and the fact that he was unable to appreciate the morality of his act. And in that way, it wasn't done with the same malicious intent as a typical attempted murder trial, really hit home in terms of just how young and fragile students can be, that everyone is, but that students especially can be.
Yeah, Samantha, one advantage of having this treasure trove of literature through your coverage and extensive coverage is that UBC now has access to what went on and the complexities of this case. What do you think would be the legacy of the Al-Mustadi case, and if this should be sort of a reference point for UBC's mental health team to really get around and use this as something to speak about and address future cases?
Absolutely. I think we are seeing a little bit of a change in the way that we approach mental health issues, especially with Santa Ono's now about the anniversary of his time as president here and his emphasis on those issues. And also with the introduction of programs, this one isn't that new, but Early Alert, which allows professors and administration and other adults at UBC to flag students that might be mental health concerns, or Empower Me, which is a relatively new telephone program where students that have access or are paying for the AMS health and dental plan have a 24/7 phone line, sort of akin to a suicide hotline, where they can call in about any mental health issues and talk them out. So I think that we are really moving towards a system that sees the fact that these problems need to be dealt with sooner rather than later, and it really is about tackling them at the origination and keeping students feeling healthy and capable of pursuing their degrees and all of their extracurriculars and expectations here, and not waiting until the last possible moment when they absolutely need an appointment with UBC Psychiatry. I think it's really just underscored the importance of paying attention to these early warning signs and developing programs and maybe even things such as fall reading break, which we still haven't seen, which to me personally is a little bit concerning, that can really help students with these issues before they develop into serious things.
I'm all for a fall reading break. Mm-hmm. I was like, I could have used that.
Absolutely. And the UBC is actually working on coverage of where we're at with that right now. So hopefully we'll have updates about that soon.
Amazing. Amazing. I'll be graduated by the time we get it. I'll be like, thanks, guys. Yeah. So kind of further to that, like what UBC has done in the aftermath of this. So Sadie, you're a first year student. So when you moved into res, like how, kind of what were your RAs? What was their approach to safety in res, and like, do you kind of generally feel safe in res?
Yeah, personally, I feel safe in res, but I wouldn't say there are a ton of safety procedures. We're mainly told to lock our doors and lock our windows, and not let people into the building. And if we see someone lurking around, just say something. And I think generally it works pretty well. And as far as, I think there's a lot of information given to us and available for us about mental health and where we can get support. What I don't know is how many students take up these opportunities.
Yeah, and we were kind of talking earlier about, like, alienation in residence and kind of, like, feeling alienated in campus life. And so what was kind of very... like, I would say sad to me reading about this trial was that Alma Stadi's witnesses were not really good friends of his. They were more study buddies, kind of quote unquote, or people he kind of casually encountered, like his roommate, but it didn't really seem like he had a very good bond with his roommate. And so, you know, I think like first year, it can be really overwhelming. And I think that, like, you know, you might kind of feel a sense of like, you know, okay, you kind of buddy up with your friends and then suddenly you're in school. And if you're kind of feeling overwhelmed, then, you know, that's, you're on your own. Like, so, yeah, I think that was a really interesting part of it. But yeah, it did seem like there was consensus among the witnesses about Alma Stadi. Like, would you say it seemed as though that was kind of, it was agreed upon that, like, his behavior was abnormal in the weeks leading up to it?
Yeah, absolutely. Quite a few of the witnesses testified that they had known him to be a very polite and cheerful person and that his demeanor in the weeks leading up to the trial was definitely atypical in that it was approaching concerning. There was this weird duality of there being the whole this is typical stress situation and also he's not the type of person that would attempt to murder a woman living in his residence. So that was very interesting. But I think that when we're thinking about the facts of this case, that a lot, it became apparent that he was experiencing paranoia about his professors, which was very interesting. Starting right at the beginning of September, he thought that his math professor in particular was making comments that were addressed to the whole class, but somehow targeting him or directed at him. In particular, he thought that when he was skateboarding across campus, that students were watching him. And those delusions and paranoia, which I think are atypical even for a very stressed student, of course, really built up until this sort of breaking point. So the witnesses kind of testified that this wasn't typical for him and that this stress really must have been a factor, but at the same time, it wasn't until he took the stand and the psychiatrist took the stand that we really began to understand the dimension of just how serious these issues were, which is what would have led to the not criminally responsible conviction, because a case of extreme, extreme stress, even though it might be atypical would not have led to this conviction. He was definitely experiencing serious mental health issues related to delusions.
Mm. Yeah, Samantha, I was just wondering, this was a criminal trial nonetheless. What was Al-Mustadi's body language in the courtroom and also of the counsel and the defense and the judge throughout this trial? He's a kid in the end. So did they soften their approach a bit, especially when it comes to their body language and their tone? Or did this go on as like a typical criminal trial?
Mm-hmm. I think this goes back to how young he is, but there was definitely a huge rigidity in the way that he was sitting throughout the entire trial, kind of just staring straight ahead, not making eye contact with any of the witnesses, maybe with the judge occasionally, very stoic and upset and withdrawn looking most of the time. When he testified, his answers were quite clipped and brief, and his tone was very curt and withdrawn again. And we did actually, the court heard both the judge and the prosecution ask him to speak up multiple times. And I think that does attest to how stressful being in a foreign courtroom for the first time can be. But the judge did mention her closing remarks, which I thought was interesting, that she hadn't taken any of that, typical but interesting, that she hadn't taken any of that demeanor into account. And then, in fact, we heard from a lot of witnesses, as I said previously, that he was normally a cheerful and polite person, but it did absolutely set a tone in the courtroom of his demeanor. And he did apologize. He did get visibly upset. And when he apologized to Mary Hare, he was given an opportunity at the end of his cross-examination, I believe it was, and he turned to her and said, "I'm really, really sorry, Mary. I really am," which was quite a poignant moment for the court and for her, I think. I don't want to speak for her, but that's how it came across, and it was just very heavy. You could tell the weight that was weighing on him throughout the trial. But aside from having to ask him to speak up a few times, there was quite a friendly, calm, polite rapport between himself and his defense counsel and the prosecution and the judge, which was nice. In that sense, it was very typical and very calm.
So Mary, the victim, she is no longer at UBC. Do we know like what she is doing now or not at all?
Not to the best of my knowledge. No.
Okay. I think one part that's interesting is that Al-Mustadi is an international student. He's from Saudi Arabia, so he's not even from Canada, but like this event is gonna like forever, maybe not forever, but for the future is gonna link him to Vancouver and is really gonna like kind of keep him here, which I think is like really daunting because he's so young. I think that kind of really like weighed on me a lot, and for Mary as well. It's like when you're having to go through this case and you're not from here, like you're gonna have to kind of keep coming back. And I do think of almost like the financial repercussions of that on both of their families. Like they're gonna have to, you know, their families probably had to fly here or come from other places in order to like be present at this trial. And I think another thing in terms of the fact that, you know, he was an international student is like, I know that some of my friends who are international students, there's like, they've echoed like having almost a double pressure of stress because they're paying more to be here. So it's like even more, I have to get good grades, you know, in order to succeed. And I think that so much of that is, you know, really weighs on people. So, yeah, Sam, thank you so much for being here with us and for your excellent coverage. And we look forward to more amazing UBC stories. Hopefully, maybe a little bit happier in the future. Hopefully. And yeah, hopefully we won't have more events like this on campus. But yeah, you guys did a great job covering this. And I know that a lot of the student population was following up with this as we went along.
Oh, thank you so much. And it was like a pleasure to be here. I will be back anytime.
Yay. Yeah, so we're going to take a little break. But coming up, we're going to switch over to a lighter tone. We're going to the MOA. We're going to hang out at an artsy event, and we're going to talk to some people who made art out of old bike parts. So really exciting. Stay tuned.
Did you know that Thrive Week is next week? Thrive is a campus organization dedicated to building positive mental health for everyone at UBC. UBC Campus Experience is celebrating by putting out a podcast around reducing the stigma of mental health by sharing the lived experiences of students. The pilot podcast, produced by Archie Stapleton, will follow Alexandra Mann, a student leader on campus, and her struggle with mental health, learning disabilities, and the intersections of the two. Tune in to hear the pilot episode and learn more about how you can get involved in creating a safer space on the UBC Vancouver campus.
Crimes and Treasons Radio, this is Riff Raff. Every Tuesday from 9 to 11 p.m. on 101.9 FM.
Yes, yes, you and I rocking with the best, 101.9 CITR Radio. Crimes and Treasons, this is your boy Just Blaze. Right now you're rocking with Jules Andre Brown, Rolly Rails, Jamal Steels, and Horsepower. You know what it is, right?
Yo, it's Iron Sue, man. I want to shout out Crimes and Treasons Radio, man. CITR 101.9, man. Turn up, turn up, turn up.
Mangan, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 in Vancouver and surrounding university areas. They want to be loved by robots, need love too. They want to be loved by you.
I was a prisoner.
Cocaine addiction.
Cocaine took my drink. It made me lie, steal.
Cocaine took my will, my soul.
And all I wanted was more cocaine. Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
Contact Cocaine Anonymous toll-free by calling 866-662-8300 or find them online at ca-bc.ca.
Welcome back to the UBC Happy Hour. I'm Sadie, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory. We were just talking to Sam McCabe, who is one of the news editors at the UBC, about the Amistad trial. If you want to learn more about this trial, head to the UBC's website and you can catch up on the trial with their excellent coverage. Next up, we're heading to the Museum of Anthropology.
Yeah, so Julia Ferry, one of our awesome contributors, she attended an event yesterday at the MOA, and the event was called Night Shift, Day of the Dead. So this event was part of MOA's monthly event series, Night Shift, where the museum is transformed into a hub of living, breathing culture. So they have like a stocked cash bar and kind of like interactive art. And every month there's a different theme. So it's pretty cool. It occurs the first month of every Thursday at the MOA. And admission is $10. But if you're a UBC student or staff, or if you're a MOA member or an Indigenous person, then admission is free. So MOA's Day of the Dead event was a multicultural interpretation of Day of the Dead. So although Day of the Dead is typically celebrated in Central and South America, given the multicultural perspective of the MOA, this event incorporated different cultures' way of acknowledging death. So Julia interviewed a programmer at the MOA, Kevin, about the event, and she also talked to a participant who was involved in the MOA activities. His name was Spencer. So here it is.
Hello, my name is Kev.
Okay, so we're at the Museum of Anthropology.
Yes. It's Day of the Dead festivities, so it's a performance surrounding Day of the Dead, I should ask April for the actual name, because I got here late. There's a performance, there's a few things. We've got an artist booth, we had an artist here at the museum who did a live painting and also had some of his works on display. We had an art station for people to actually draw and do art themselves. We had a stand set up, almost like a shrine sort of set up that you would see in Day of the Dead, sort of in Mexico, sort of set up. There was mole on it, I think, even, and I was like, oh, mole, that's very Mexican, that's my favorite Mexican food. So that's kind of cool. excuse me. We also had, obviously, the open bar and some space out there for people to enjoy a live DJ performance. And then we had the performance in here, which there were originally planned to be two. However, because of the popularity and the number of people arriving, we ended up having two and then a third one at 10:15. So, yeah, we had a pretty intense or large amount of people show up.
It's really changing from what museum used to be before.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say it's necessarily unsurprising for a museum to do something that maybe breaks the mold or is experimental, because the museum itself started as a kind of experimental thing, and it's always had that sort of spirit in it. But I do think that the big thing about the performance that makes it very unique and interesting is we have a moving performance where we start in one part of the museum, but but move through other parts into other sections. So during the performance, they pass through a river, and it's a river of sort of anger, and they have to get through that section, and there's visuals and audio that causes you, it's very a lot of sound. Once you get past that, you basically go to a part where the performer gets possessed and eats your heart, and that's kind of fun. And then you pass on to the last two sections. The third one, which would be the third level of sort of the underworld, is a section where your fear is, you see an image of yourself, and your fear is unleashed. So you have to think about a fear, and it sort of comes through the experience. And then the last section, you go and you meet with the god of the underworld, but I can't remember the name. It's a Nahuatl name. So I wouldn't be able to replicate it for you. I'd probably have to ask April for the full name. But he oversees the dead, and he basically judges the people who are there. So he asks you what happened during each of these trials, and how the newcomers did, because in the show everyone has died. For the purpose of the narrative, and if you pass, then you get a second chance at life and move on. But you have to remember your paper, which is the thing you wanted to do. That you wrote a paper at the beginning when you wanted to write what you wanted to do before you died. So now you get to kind of think about that as you leave. So very kind of morbid, but that's the point. Very interesting, and unlike other performances we've had, for sure. Hopefully I didn't cough too much during that explanation.
Oh, no, I was just checking that I was recording, because that was a great, great introduction.
Okay, cool.
I'm just wondering about there's a lot of ambient noise that's quite frightening. So do you reckon that this performance is supposed to be scary?
I think it's supposed to invoke unease and possibly some form of nervousness, maybe anxiety. I wouldn't necessarily say scary, because it is it's a dramatic piece, and you're in a setting that doesn't really convince you necessarily all the time that it's like that. But I would say it's very evocative and emotional, which is kind of cool.
For a
second.
Yeah. So could you guys describe to me what you're doing right now?
So we're currently decorating paper mache skulls, and we're just coloring them. Most people are inspired by sugar skulls, which there are a few pictures of them on the table.
Yeah. Very beautiful. Yeah. Lots of colors.
Yeah, it's very colorful. It's very different than typical Western traditions of death and passing and whatnot.
Yeah, definitely. What does it make you feel to have a different form of celebrating death?
I think it's really interesting. I mean, I'm biased because I study death, but it's super interesting just to see how different responses to something, because I don't know, death is something that's universal, and it's so moving, and people can get so emotional over it, but just there's so many different ways you can respond, and I think that this is a really interesting in a different way that we don't really see much of in, like, Canada. So it's cool that we have the opportunity to, like, explore this side of, like, South American and, like, Central American culture.
Thanks, Spencer.
Hey, so you're back listening to UBC Happy Hour. You just heard Julia Ferry, one of our contributors at the Museum of Anthropology, where she attended their awesome nighttime event. So we have even more arts and culture for you. So this is Amy Chandra with her weekly arts update. She's going to fill you in on what's going on this week on campus in terms of arts and culture, so you won't miss out on any of the action. She interviewed a couple of awesome biking ladies from the AMS Bike Co-op about their upcoming fundraiser, Pedaling Art. So here it is, guys.
Hi there, this is Amy Chandra here with your weekly arts update. I'll be going through the week and be telling you what sort of activities we have going on at UBC. So this has been happening since November 2nd, but the UBC Opera Ensemble are doing their opera Orfeo ed Eurydice. It's based on the Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. It is at 7:30 in the old auditorium. Tickets are $45 for adults, $35 for seniors, $20 for students, and $15 for UBC students. It seems a really cool opportunity to see opera. I will be seeing it. It's my first time seeing opera, actually. I'm very excited, and it's by your fellow students, so go out and support them. Saturday, November 4th, the UBC Dance Club is having a dance decathlon. So it's basically like a large scavenger hunt happening during the afternoon, a dance scavenger hunt to be more specific. So they say arrive early to make teams. It's from 1 o'clock to 5:45 in the Great Hall in the Nest. Doesn't matter your experience, whether you're a professional dancer or have never danced once in your life. Go out there, meet some new people, have fun, take a break from your midterms. Monday, November 6th. The UBC Slam Poetry Club is having a writing workshop. So come visit to get a chance to workshop your poetry, and you can also present your poetry to the people there, maybe get some feedback or just get it off your chest, basically. But you do not have to share it. You can just sit back, listen to others, be inspired by them. All levels of experience are welcome. So don't worry if you're writing your first poem. That's great. And free tea and instant coffee will be there, and bring your own mug. It's from 2 to 3:30 in room 2514 of the Nest. Also on Monday, November 6th, the UBC Asian Calligraphy Club is holding a workshop, a calligraphy workshop for all those interested in learning the art of calligraphy. You do not need your own materials. Brushes will be provided, and you have to RSVP on their Facebook event. So check that out if you want a relaxing evening practicing calligraphy and chatting with some new friends. That is 5 to 6:30 in Irving K. Barber Learning Center, room 156. And if you're not a member of that club, it'll be $2. Moving on to Tuesday, November 7th. That is opening night for the UBC Players Club, their presentation of Doubt, a Parable. So that is a Pulitzer Prize-winning play, and it's a story about arising accusations between a nun and a priest, and deals with the themes of moral certainty and truth. It's playing till November 12th. Tickets are $8 for members, $10 for students, and $12 for just general public. It'll be from the 7th to the 12th at 7 p.m. in the Dorothy Somerset Studio. So that's a completely student-run production, and it's a really great play. I really recommend going and seeing that. Wednesday, November 8th, Blank Vinyl Project is having their open mic night. So if you want to come and present your singing, slam poetry, or beatboxing, or anything else in between, come to the Gallery 2.0 at 6:45 is when sign-up starts, though they recommend coming earlier as spots do fill up quickly. And the performances will start at 7. And also there will be two featured artists there that night, Here North Here and Carlo Aragon. So come check that out. Even if you don't want to perform, check out our student talent. Thursday, November 9th, the musical theater troupe here at UBC is having a show called Miscast. It's basically a presentation of some of the members from the musical theater troupe will be performing songs that they love from musicals, from roles that they would love to play, but unfortunately will not likely get to play in real life. So you get to see them performing their dream songs. The minimum donation is $2. It's from 6 to 8 at a location that is to be determined. So go to their Facebook event for updates if you're very interested. And it just seems like a great night with lots of talented people singing great Broadway tunes. Also, Thursday, November 9th, Wives and Daughters is premiering at the Frederick Wood Theater. It's a play adapted by the UBC Theater and Film professor Jacqueline Firkins from the 1860s serial novel by Elizabeth Gaskell. And it's about how this one young woman's life is turned upside down when her stepmother and new stepsister move in with her, and they say that they have a talent of improving people, and they also bring along with them a wealth of secrets. This production will showcase the talent of our BFA acting students and our BFA design and production students. It looks very cool. I think if you like Jane Austen, you might like this. So I'm really excited. I will be going and seeing it as well. So tickets for adults are $24.50. For seniors, it's $16.50. Students, $11.50. And youth, only $5. So that will be playing from November 9th to the 25th. Wednesdays through Saturdays at the Frederick Wood Theater. Lastly, Friday, November 10th, Lace Up for Kids improv show is happening. So UBC Improv is teaming up with UBC Recreation for the Lace Up Kids. It's an annual charity for the Rare Disease Foundation and the BCCH Foundation to help raise money for children with rare diseases. So you can come see some improv, and it'll be for a good cause. So doors are at 6:30. Come earlier than that, though, if you want a ticket. Show will be at 7 in Neville Scarf 100. A minimum of $3 donations at the door and $4.50 online. Also happening Friday, November 10th, Peddling Art, second annual fundraiser and bike art auction. That is run by the AMS Bike Co-op. It's a silent art action fundraiser featuring art from over 30 local artists, live performances by West Coast Bosa, TC, Emily Rose, and DJ Wizbo. There's a ton of raffle prizes there, and there's a cash bar. And it is 7 to midnight at the GAM Gallery. Prices to get in are $5 to $20 on a sliding scale, or you can donate a functional U-lock with a key to get in. And no one will be turned away for lack of funds, so if you aren't unable to pay, do not worry. You can find out more about this event. I did an interview with Sin Williams and Sunny Nestler, who are part of the AMS Bike Co-op, and they can tell us more about this great event. Hi there, this is Amy Shandro with CITR. I'm here with Sin Williams and Sunny Nestler from the AMS Bike Co-op. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey, thank you for having us.
So tell us a bit about what the Bike Co-op actually does around campus.
Sure. So the Bike Co-op is a student club, and we run a number of programs on campus as well as around Vancouver. We also have a full service and do-it-yourself bike shop and tool share called the Bike Kitchen, which is in front of Brock Hall. We run several programs out of our office. So we do like outreach. We have set up booths and give free tune-ups to people on campus and different groups that ask us to come out. We do like classroom style lecture workshops to teach people about cycling repair and safety. And we run a number of access programs like Women and Queer Night. We have an LGBTQ2I night. And on Tuesday nights, we have an event called Purple and Yellow Night, where we teach people how to take apart and repair bicycles that are part of our free UBC bike share program.
Awesome. So the most recent event you're having, it's going to be next Friday. It's called Peddling Art. Can you guys tell us a bit about what's happening there?
Absolutely. So Peddling Art is taking place on November 10th at GAM Gallery at 110 East Hastings from 7 p.m. to 12 a.m. And basically, Peddling Art is a silent auction style fundraiser and art show. So we have a bunch of local artists that have contributed either bike-themed art or art that engages with like bikes and cycling culture, or art made from bike parts, like recycled bike parts, stuff that probably would have ended up in the trash or a recycling center and instead has been turned into art. So things like bike tube earrings. What else do we got?
We have a number of paintings and drawings and kind of wall art that artists from around town have contributed that are bicycle themed or related. So we have a number of things that are like sort of your more traditional definition of artwork that you'd hang on a wall. And then we also have a lot of utilitarian objects that have been fashioned out of old bike parts, like Zen was talking about. So a combination of those two things.
Awesome. So you two have art in the auction, I've heard. Any sneak peeks on the pieces that you guys have?
You can definitely look forward to our secret special edition t-shirts, which I guess the hint I will give is that they are also related to a drawing that I will be contributing to the show.
Very cool.
Yeah, leading up to the event, I ran a workshop on how to make bike tube jewelry, collars, and earrings. So there'll be a bunch of bike tube jewelry that was made by people who attended the class, as well as stuff that I have made for the show as well. But there's also going to be like bike lever coat racks and like sculptures and like handbags, all sorts of cool stuff.
Also, Sin is like a veteran jeweler. So...
That's cool.
Excited.
That's a really good variety of stuff. I love that. And I understand the proceeds are going to some bike-themed programs, BC Libre and Pedals for People. Can you tell us a bit about what they do?
Yeah, sure. So so BC Libre is a program that we run in the summer. We work with groups on some of the farms around Vancouver where our food comes from. The program specifically reaches out to temporary seasonal farm workers that need bicycles to get off of the farms to access things like services and groceries. And we also are setting up some tool shares at a couple of the farms and doing repairs on those bicycles. Pedals for the People is a program that runs year-round. It's managed by our Community Bikes, which is on Main and Broadway. And they do a similar service where they're providing bicycles, repairs, and accessories for low or no cost to people who could not otherwise afford those things. And that's sort of on a drop-in slash waitlist system. And we occasionally team up with our Community Bikes in a variety of ways to run both of those programs. So that's why it's a fundraiser for both things.
Okay, that's awesome. That's a really good cause. So there's also some other stuff happening at the event. You have raffle prizes. What are the prizes? Can you give us a few?
So far we have some free tune-ups courtesy of Dunbar Cycles and socks and water bottles. We're currently reaching out to a bunch of other local businesses to ask for raffle prizes. Sunny, do we have any other ones yet?
I don't think the confirmations are formal enough for me to announce on radio. But if you are a local bike shop or related organization and you want to participate, you're also welcome to reach out to us, and we are still accepting raffle donations. We're also still accepting art submissions. So if you are an artist or a craftsperson or an artisan and you have made something bicycle themed or related and you want to contribute, we are not asking for donations. This is a 50-50 auction, so you will receive 50% of the final sale price of your work.
Yeah, and our contributors so far have been a really big variety of people, like some like veteran local artists who are doing like really traditional art, and also just like local craftspeople and hobbyists as well. So there's a huge range of stuff going to be at the show, and it's going to be accessible at also a wide variety of price points. So there'll be stuff, you know, going for $20, $30, and also bigger art pieces that'll be hundreds of dollars.
Wow. That's awesome. I really like how it gets tons of different communities involved. People like bikers, cyclists in Vancouver, and the art community. I think that's really, really awesome. What other events do you guys have coming up? Maybe just a short tidbit in the future. If people can't come to this one, what else can they come and see?
All right. So we have, leading up to Pedaling Art, we have been doing a crafting workshop series called Spare Parts, in which we're teaching folks how to make cool objects and usable things out of recycled bike parts. So we've already done two of them so far, and the next one that we're doing is on Monday, November 6th at our Community Bikes, and we'll be teaching folks how to make coat racks out of brake levers. Other events that we do on a regular basis include things like our Women and Queer Night, which happens on the second Wednesday of every month from 6 to 9 p.m. At the Bike Kitchen, and it's like a free night where anyone who identifies as a cis or trans woman or queer or genderqueer can come and use the shop tools for free and get free advice from our mechanics on hand, and it's a space that's facilitated by women and queer folk. And we also do a similar night to that on the fourth Wednesday of every night called LGBTQ2I night, and again it's free shop time for folks who identify with those communities and can come and use the shop space for free, eat free pizza, listen to music, hang out, and just connect with other folks. What else?
It's fun. Also, we're going to be testing an event in the spring called Unibike, which is going to be like a town hall style meeting for the membership of the co-op. So if you are currently a bike co-op member, or you are thinking of becoming a bike co-op member, which you can do in person at the bike kitchen anytime, then we're going to be inviting you to this event. You can keep an eye out for it in the spring. There will also be food.
And prizes. Awesome. That sounds really rad. And this seems like a really cool part of the UBC community to get a part of. Thank you guys for coming in for the interview, and best of luck with the whole auction.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Yeah.
And you can find more information online at bikecoop.ca/pedalingart/.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you for tuning in to UBC Happy Hour. I'm Alex Lenz.
And I'm Sadie Lai. On this week's episode, we talked with Sam McCade about the Alma Study Trial, followed by Julia Ferry at the Museum of Anthropology and Amy Shandro's Arts Update, along with an interview with the AMS Bike Co-op. If you like what you heard and you want to help make this show, or if there's something happening on campus that you would like to see covered on this show, send us an email at ubcaffairs@citr.ca. You can find episodes of the UBC Happy Hour online at citr.ca.
So to close off the show, we're just going to play you a quick track by a UBC band called Melt, and that's with two L's. So they're a four-piece psychedelic rock group from West Vancouver, and they've played a bunch of shows around the city. They also played at last year's block party at UBC. They're really cool. So we're going to play you a track called Glow from their EP Visions, which was released earlier this year. And they've got a pretty sweet video for Glow on their website, www.melt.ca. So thanks again for tuning in, and we'll catch you all on the waves next week. So here's Melt with Glow.
Lay before his eyes, and as he stared inside, saw a thousand creatures follow up his life.
It's not just rich people that own the media.
I own my 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 media.